Welcome to Open Line, WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This half hour on the show, we'll talk about dogs, big dogs, little dogs, loving dogs, maybe some obnoxious dogs. And so why is it that many of us humans seek the companionship of dogs and want them in our lives? We want to play with them, tussle with them, take them on walks, clean up after them. Well, we will, at least, anyway. And we may want more than one around the house. My guest this hour, Central Ohio writer Michael Rosen, has always had companion animals in the form of dogs, and he's edited a new collection of essays about dogs. It's entitled Dogs We Love. It features essays by Jane Smiley, Edward Albee, Ann Beatty, and many other dog people. Welcome to Open Line, Michael Rosen. Good to have you back.
Thanks, as always, Fred.
And we're at 614-292-8513. Well, in Dogs We Love, the playwright Edward Albee writes, some of us just feel incomplete without the company of a dog or two. So what is it about the company of a dog?
You know, there are so many responses and so many ways to answer it. But the one that, to me, is the most profound is, you know, in our new age, our new day and age, I think dogs are exercise for our souls. You know, we spend all this time having exercise for our bodies. We want, you know, our nutrition to be this and our athletic, you know, muscles to be this. But I think that most people have found that dogs are the, not fastest way, but the best way to kind of nurture that other thing that makes us more human, maybe, gets the nature part in human mm-hmm. nature back in tune, you know, gets us feeling more the creature comforts that we really need, emphasizing, you know, the word creature. We're creatures despite the fact that we can, you know, text one another as if we were machines.
Texting animals, yes. Well, I think that's right. You say we have physical exercise. We also have exercise for a lot of exercise for the mind, but that's not necessarily the same thing as exercise for the spirit, is it?
Agreed. I also continue to look to my own dogs and cats as a means of slowing me down, you know, of giving me time away from. And, you know, part of it is discipline, like any exercise, you know, that sense of I want to stop what I'm doing. I'm going to put the dog on the leash. When I lived in the city, now I live in the country. We're going to go outside. We're going to, you know, we're going to walk for 45 minutes. We're going to try to pay attention to other things and not feel that the, you know, 65 unanswered emails, which I remember 10 years ago, I didn't have 65 things that needed me now.
Yeah.
Each day.
Right.
And so I kind of like the idea that dogs help us, their needs, their primal needs. I need to eat. I need to exercise, I need to be held, walked, you know, touched, you know, that work is a priority. And I love the idea of, I think Dogs We Love, the one thing that runs through all those personal recollections is how people have helped folks slow down, untie, center, whatever word doesn't sound too psychobabble-like.
Mm-hmm. Well, Daniel Pinkwater writes in Dogs We Love that his dog, Jacques, helps. He said he's been determined. We all know Daniel Pinkwater from National Public Radio, his
right.
audio essays, and he says he's been a proud non-exerciser. He's determined not to exercise throughout his life, but he may pay a price for that. But the on the other hand, his dog, Jacques, you know, they take a walk together every day around the lake, right? And this is his walk, and that's part of the deal. And he says he doesn't think. Some people say, well, we like dogs because they give us uncritical affection, you know,
right.
unconditional love. But he doesn't buy that. He doesn't. What do you think?
I'm with him. You know, it's very facile to say dogs give unconditional love and all of that. And I think partly it's our overcompensating for that whole era in which we assumed animals had no feelings and that we could treat them whatever way we might treat them because they're, you know, they're innate mechanisms. They're nothing more than, you know, a rote response.
Mm-hmm.
But I think now we have a very lush and still inadequate vocabulary to talk about our feelings, you know, for animals. And I think there's no question that dogs understand respect. They respect you. They don't respect you. They understand. They're maybe more forgiving than some. I mean, some dogs are very forgiving. They, you know, if they're abused, animals that have been rescued, most often can come around to be very affectionate and great members of a family. Some cannot. Uh-huh. I'm often impressed by how much how clever dogs are. I've had golden retrievers in my life or mixes, and many of them, so quickly understand the commands that they begin to understand laughter. For example, my dog Paris, we used to walk, and he had very long trousers, which you call that long hair on the hind quarters.
Mm-hmm.
And when it would be raining, we'd get to the corner, and he knew to stop and sit at every street because, we lived in the city. There were many, many streets to cross. But when it was raining, it was like, oh, man, it's soaking wet, and it's so dirty. So I would, as soon as he would, sort of do a little crouch thing, okay, and we would, and then we'd be off. So it got to be very quickly that if it was raining and we get to the corner, he would just do a little half squat. It wasn't even like, the goal, in other words, I understand, I'm not supposed to go in the street. The goal was not to sit anymore. So I love that sort of cleverness, or the fact that I would say to Paris about many things, the no command or the don't. But if I would laugh after it, he was doing something naughty. Well, that was completely like any child saying, it made you laugh? I bet you want me to do it again. And so we had many repertoires that involved that give and take, which goes completely against the idea that the dogs we love are, unconditional, only capable of one flat response that's predictable, like a behaviorist might have assigned.
Sure. Michael Rosen is editor of the new book, Dogs We Love, featuring recollections and essays by Jane Smiley, Edward Albee, Ann Beatty, and other dog people. Wonder why you have chosen to have a dog in your life. 614-292-8513. You can email comments or questions to openline@wosu.org. I think we do understand a little bit more about how animals' brains work now. I mean, I've seen dogs weigh two alternatives, choosing between
sure.
them, making a decision, and making a decision over time as well. So I think their thought process is not as simple as we used to think. Michael, you write about in your introductory essay to the book, you say that almost embarrassing intensity of feelings you have for your dogs. Few emotions are as pure, uncompromised, and often inexpressible. Let's talk about that a little bit.
That whole idea probably began with Freud, not that I know that, cover to cover. But he, a great dog person, had Chow Chows. Used to say that the reason was with humans we have very complicated emotions. With my father, let's say, I love him. He angers me about these things. He's, in other words, we have nuances of jealousy, rage, bitterness, huge affection, admiration, intimidation, you name it, all of those things.
Ambivalence, yeah.
Ambivalence, a compounding. I think with dogs, we just don't have that. When we lose a dog, it's not as though we resent it or we hold him guilty for or responsibilities around. I think it's unalloyed in a very different way with humans, which I think is why kids so immediately respond to dogs. They understand dogs, cats, animals. Their language is very similar. Like dogs don't speak mm-hmm. on this language. Like, I don't know what you mean by that. I'm sorry. You don't have to explain that again. They identify with animals in that pure sense of when you're good, we like you, we pet you, we give you treats. When you're bad, well, let's hope you don't get smacked and whatever. But, the kids, I think, learn what the repercussions of behavior are by identifying with animals. And so, to your point, these are primal, simple feelings, not that they're any less tense, but just the opposite. They're more intense because they are so conspicuous for us.
Well, the dogs are so uninhibited. I visited some friends recently, and they have two little, I don't know dog breeds. They're two little terriers or something. Anyway, I'm sort of sitting back on the couch, sort of relaxing and slumping on the couch, and one of them jumps onto my lap and climbs up my chest and begins licking my face all over the place.
Right.
And, well, you know, if a human being did that, you'd be a little reluctant to accept it. But I thought, hey, this is great, you know, totally uninhibited. And then after he finished licking my face, he stood on my chest and started growling at me. And I immediately understood what he wanted. He wanted to play. He wanted
to have
a ball thrown, or he wanted to play tug of war. So that's what we did. And I think it's just so... it's just so unalloyed. I mean, and you know, even to watch dogs in the park, right? I mean, just to see them, they're so full of joy. And what always amuses me is when their owners call them, and 99% of the time, you know what happens when you call a dog and they're in the park?
Sure.
They take their good old time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I think the two dogs that were giving you the tongue bath clearly must have recognized you from Open Line. But,
yeah. but they're fans of the show.
That's right, fans of the show. But no, I do think that's yet another thing that is probably echoed in many of the essays in Dogs We Love, and that is that sense of inhibition, that dogs really have no threshold. Again, maybe it's that same idea of they're not weighing the situation like, well, Fred's nice, but this is really our first meeting. Would he like the tongue bath? Or what if he gets mad at me? No, it's just like, hey, let's go. Exactly. And I think people, many of us, look to dogs. Well, it's legendary, the whole idea of, you know, I have a handsome dog on a leash. Maybe I'll meet someone in the park. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, dogs really do help us get into the world in a frowsier way than we would, in a more uninhibited way. Look at people playing with their dogs. Folks that are particularly uptight let their dogs, carry them forward into the world in a zany, giddy, childish way. And I think we value that. I don't think many of us really want to be as adult-like.
Right.
I think we'd be happier being a little more outdoorsy, a little more dogged in our approach to things.
Yeah. So, You know, and of course, dogs, they're uninhibited. They violate our personal space. I mean, that dog that jumped on my lap was, you know, I mean, if a human got that close to me, say, hey, back off, you know.
Right.
Now, some people don't like that. I know a fellow who doesn't like dogs because they do continually violate personal. They just jump on your lap. They put their paws up on you. I like that. I enjoy that because it's like a childlike kind of thing. Hey, let's go, they say.
There's definitely no question that there are people for whom dogs are, you know, they do cross that barrier. In fact, you know, my little introduction, which you alluded to, I sort of miss or appropriated Shakespeare to say some people are born with dogs, some achieve dogs, and some people have dogs thrust upon them. So instead of greatness, we have dogs here. And I think people who don't grow up with dogs or don't grow up with cats often don't get it. And often it's their spouse or someone else important in their life that brings that connection. And, you know, sure, you can, over and over you'll hear people say, you know, until we got so-and-so, I didn't even know what it was that dogs brought out in me or what a cat would do for my life. I just thought they were, you know, whatever. You fed them and they shed. And it's true that it is one of those phenomena that I think, despite your experience of third-person experience, when it becomes first-person, you can't imagine it until it's actually there.
Well, you know, in Dogs We Love, you have an essay by Susan Conant, whose father loved dogs, but her mother loathed them, she writes.
Yeah.
And her mother took out a class of, when one of the dogs had puppies, her mother took out a classified ad in the paper, and the classified ad said, "My husband's $50 puppies for $25. If a man answers, hang up." I mean, so all their lives, this married couple, one of them just adored dogs, and the others loathed and despised them. I mean, you know, you wonder they could live in the same house.
You know, that's a fabulous essay because... Susan actually, her father bred golden retrievers, and Susan herself is the author of all those wonderful Holly Hunter dog lover mysteries. And she herself is a Malamute person, as is Dan Pinkwater, as you mentioned. Actually, he's more the Siberian Huskies, but in that same wonderful sled dog kind of arena. But she was always feeling she'd never rise to her father's expectations because she wasn't a purebred golden retriever. Mm-hmm. I mean, she herself felt in her dad's eyes, you know, the sort of ideal thing was this certain beautiful kind of confirmation of this elegant animal, brilliant, and that, you know, she was always trying to be a good dog too, in that world of a particularly dog, or at least on the one side of the family, related character. I mean, that was the pleasure in reaching out to these people. I found, you know, 18 writers that I knew from their own body of work, their short stories, their novels, that dogs played an important part. They just kept recurring. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote to them specifically to say, and many of them I didn't know personally, to say, listen, am I right? You know, you have dogs, you know, you write about them a lot, or you've connected with them a lot. Like, for example, Robert Rosenblum, the late art critic, you know, had done a book, in fact, looking at art in depictions of great paintings. And so I actually didn't know him personally, or if he had a dog. I just sort of, you know, put it out there to say, I'm doing this book. I'm wondering if this would make sense to you. And of course, he wrote back this, you know, wonderful personal letter about how, in fact, he'd never had dogs and until Archie, the bull, the English bulldog that came into their lives, and how this, you know, especially for someone who lived in New York and had a certain kind of life, he discovered that merely having a dog, you know, when you went through your doggy neighborhood, changed everything.
Sure.
The way you encountered one another. He admitted what most dog people do. You know, I probably have met 25 dogs in my neighborhood. I can tell you every name, every breed. I talk to all their owners every day. I couldn't tell you one of the owner's names.
You know, bingo, because, you know, Michael, that's fascinating, because I was just about to say that when I go up and down my block, I can tell you there's Max, there's Woody, there's Buddy, there's Vegas, there's a cat by the name of Joey who comes out to say hello to you. Most of the owners' names, I have no clue. I've met them a half a dozen times, and I always ask their names. I have no idea what their names are. But I'll say, hi, Vegas, to the dog, but I don't know what, I have no idea what the owners' names are.
I have no explanation, Fred, other than I know you're not alone. And
well, what is that saying about us, Michael?
I know. I don't know. I mean, I think about this all the time. I think about memory and, you know, what is it? Maybe it's that, you know, the animals are so unique. You know, they do look so, I don't know. You remember them because they were different looking, but
let's, Michael, be honest. There's more to it than that.
Yeah.
I mean, we're enjoying the dogs maybe more than we're enjoying the people. When if you remember the dog's name, but you don't remember the person's name, and you've been told it six times, what does that tell you?
Well, I have corrected myself. You know, I've thought about this enough that my natural inclination, you know, when I'm in an office and someone has a dog, when I meet someone and there's a dog, but, you know, to immediately say, right, don't just go hang out with the dog. Do a little something with the people first, and then say, could I, you know, which, you know, of course, is not just courteous, but it's safe to say, hey, would you like me to meet your, or can I meet your dog, and rather than just get down on all fours and start.
By the way, a few more minutes with Michael Rosen, Dogs We Love, 614-292-8513, open line at WOSU.org. You know, and I don't know if you're this way, Michael, but sometimes people will say, well, there's going to be a party somewhere at so-and-so's house. And I don't know the person, but they say, would you like to come to the party? And you know what? One of my first questions is do they have a dog? Because, you know, you can go to a lot of parties and meet a lot of people, but, you know, I mean, if the party's dull, or even if it isn't, you've got the dog to hang out with.
Fred, my question is, can I bring my dog?
That's great. Yeah, right.
No, seriously. No, but there is something about that social facilitation, that comfort, that ease, that really, you know, our companion animals. I think that's why we have them in our lives. It does make so much of that easier. The, you know, all the scientific studies now brandish the fact that, you know, your blood pressure is lowered just with a dog in the room. There are so many facilities now, whether it's hospitals or senior centers, where they have dogs not simply for companionship, but there is a definite improvement in will to live, optimism, a sense of well-being that being near companion animals instills. And that's not a small thing.
No, and you know, another question I had: do good dogs go to heaven? And that's not a a slight question, because you know, for many people who believe in an afterlife, they believe that these animals, which have been so faithful, ought to have some kind of reward. You know, and there, I know there's a patron saint for cats, and I think there's also a patron saint for dogs in a certain religions.
You know, I've read many things, because the question interests me, as it does you, Fred. Of the remarks made by others that I think about as consolation for my own, you know, life and loss of dogs and cats, one is, you know, I wouldn't recognize, you know, if I got there and there weren't dogs there, I would know I hadn't made it. And, you know, in other words, if the very idea of what my bliss would be, what my everlife should be, it should have the richness afforded by the relationships in my life. And if you say, look, all of my life I've had companion animals, that's been a vital part of my life, that would be something you'd recognize as part of the life of the soul. The other lovely thing, I remember a Charles Barsotti cartoon that I put in my first book of stories about dogs called The Company of Dogs many years ago, in which there's a man rising into heaven, you know, through the clouds, and here's the man, you know, the big man upstairs, there's a little tiny dog beside him, and the caption is, "Oh, so you're Bobby that he's been talking about all these years."
Yeah,
that lovely sense of, you know, homecoming, that lovely, you know, idea that we're to be reunited in some overall sense of things.
Sure. We just have about a minute and a half left, and I want to mention, Michael, your profits from your book, Dogs We Love, will go to the Company of Animals Fund, which you began in 1990. Just give us a slight take on that fund, if you would.
Yeah, no, the basic ideas, there have been 8 books. This is the latest one, in which, as I approach the various talents, these renowned authors, I ask them to donate their work, because we take the profits that these books make. And there's a fund that I began literally with these books' revenues to support local humane efforts.
Here in Central Ohio. Yeah.
Here in Central Ohio. And we've done 100 organizations over the country, totaling about $370,000. This new book, I hope, will continue that revenue stream to support, you know, Columbus Dog Connection, the Capillary Humane Society, people that are basically helping less lucky dogs find homes or afford veterinary care, be reunited with their owners, that kind of work.
Mm-hmm. All right. Hey, and just in 30 seconds, how about Leona Helmsley? $8 billion with a B for all kinds of dogs, to help dogs?
You
know, amazing.
I hope her attorneys don't dilute it terribly, because that could be one of those moments, as with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, where something that has been ongoing could actually turn around in an incredibly profound way.
Yeah.
So let the heiress of the empire actually do one really great good thing, and that would be fabulous.
Sure. It would be indeed. Michael Rosen edited the book Dogs We Love, with recollections by Jane Smiley, Edward Albee, and Beatty, and other dog people. Michael, delightful. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Fred.
When we come back, journalist Rebecca Fannin on China's rise as a high-tech giant on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, how the mob owned Cuba, then lost it to the revolution. We talk with T.J. English, author of the new book Havana Nocturne. Also, Michael Sokolov talks about his new book Warrior Girls, and investigates the epidemic of injuries in girls and women's sports. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air begins later this afternoon at 1 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. It is 74 degrees at 10:30. Your membership with WOSU provides for the news and information you rely on. And in this pivotal election year, your support is more important than ever. Becoming a member is easy when you go online to wosu.org/give. Thank you for your continued support of WOSU 820, NPR News. Listen to Morning Edition now on WOSU 89.7 FM for your weekday morning update on the news. It's from 5 to 9 a.m. And in the weather forecast for today, scattered showers and thunderstorms throughout the day, a high around 80. Mostly cloudy tonight with more rain and more thunderstorms, a low around 60.
Support for WOSU comes from the Columbus Metropolitan Club, presenting a variety of speakers on the relevant issues of today. More information is available at www.columbusmetroclub.org.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820, NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This half hour on Open Line, journalist Rebecca Fannin tells us how China is becoming a global leader in technology. Venture capitalists from all over the world are negotiating deals with Chinese tech entrepreneurs, just like they did in Silicon Valley's early days. They are becoming wealthy, these entrepreneurs, many of them, and sometimes rock star famous in China. Chinese President Hu Jintao says that high-tech innovation will be the cornerstone of China's economic growth. Chinese innovators already have produced a browser that rivals and maybe in some ways surpasses Microsoft's Internet Explorer. There's an online bookseller, DangDang.com, that trumps Amazon in some ways, a search engine that is fighting Google for the vast China marketplace, and a big social networking site as well, and much more. It's a fascinating story. Rebecca Fannin is international editor of the Hong Kong weekly Asian Venture Capital Journal. Her new book is Silicon Dragon, How China is Winning the Tech Race. Welcome to Columbus, Rebecca Fannin. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
614-292-8513. If you'd like to enter the conversation, you can email comments and questions to openline at wosu.org. So the center of technology is shifting. It's not so much Woodside, California and Silicon Valley anymore, huh?
That's right. It's places like Zhangjiagang Software Park and Tsinghua University.
And tell us what goes on. I have the impression of all these venture capitalists are descending upon China and meeting with these guys in coffee shops. I mean, there's Starbucks over there as well, and making deals. Is that what it's like?
That's right. You go to the hotel lobbies and you'll see venture capitalists there meeting with entrepreneurs. You go to the Starbucks there at the software park. You see the same thing. It's like Woodside in Beijing and Shanghai.
So there's approximately 644,000 engineers graduating annually from Chinese universities. I mean, and many of them are going to go into high-tech pursuits.
That's right. And many of them are bright, young, talented graduates, eager, motivated, switched on.
So China has the most mobile phone users in the world. Is that right?
Over 500 million already.
Of course, that's probably explained by the fact partly that China at least always had a lousy phone system. I mean, I don't know if it still is, but I mean, the landlines were terrible.
Right. So they've been able to jump right over that and go into the mobile generation.
And they have the second most internet users in the world.
Right.
And I guess some of this makes sense just because they have a huge population, right? So they're going to have large numbers. Eh?
Yeah. So the penetration is not really all that high. It's about 10% to 12% internet penetration, but the mobile phone penetration is a lot more, but it's just growing so rapidly.
And they have two of the top 10 websites in the world.
Right, search engine Baidu and a instant messaging service called Tencent QQ.
Well, I went to Baidu.com, you know, B-A-I-D-O-U.com, you know, the search engine. It's like Google.
Yeah.
And the main page, I mean, it looks like Google. It's very, you know, simple and plain. And so I typed in some English phrases and it took me to a whole lot of sites.
Right. Yeah. It's amazing. And you can get translations with the Baidu site as well.
Now, but the Chinese government can't enjoy all of this, I'm sure. Baidu is a search engine. I mean, is it prohibited? Is it blocked from certain places that the Chinese government is going to see as somehow seditious?
Well, you're always going to bump up against the Great Firewall if you're in China. Even Google does. Mm-hmm. Google is operating in China, and their own search results are censored in China.
How does the government go about that? I mean, is Google self-centered? Does the government give them a list and say, here are the kinds of sites we don't want people to go to and you've got to block? Or does the government do it? So how does it work?
Google does self-censor. And then China also has these internet policemen who guard against certain words going over servers.
And certain words like maybe what?
Tiananmen Square, politically sensitive words, Tibet, Dalai Lama.
Oh, yeah. So, are they very effective at blocking these sites? I mean, sites can spring up in a day, you know. Are they very effective at doing this?
They seem to be very effective at doing it.
Mm-hmm.
When I am in China and I search certain sites, periodically I'll get bumped off or I'll just see a blank screen.
Mm.
And at one point, my own website was blocked in China, which
really?
I was very surprised about.
What is your website? It's
RebeccaFannin.com.
Okay, and they blocked it. Why would they do that?
Well, they've since unblocked it, which I think is a good thing because the book's very positive about China's future as a technology innovator.
Yeah, your book Silicon Dragon is not a huge critique. I mean, you introduce this to some of the top entrepreneurs, and you're pretty enthusiastic about what they've done.
I am.
Yeah, but it's a difficult for somebody like Google operating in China because we know, and with Yahoo, there have been problems because the Chinese authorities, as authorities in any country, might say, look, we need to know the name of the person who has this website and we need to track them down because they violated the law. Now, in America, you might not hesitate to do that because you know that probably the police most likely are going for some good reason. But in China, they could be picking out a political dissident and throwing him into jail. And I guess that's exactly what happened with Yahoo. Huh?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yahoo turned over the names of two journalist bloggers to the Chinese officials. And those bloggers were later jailed. Yahoo was roundly criticized for this action and in Washington, D.C. But if you're operating in China, you really have no choice but to obey by the local rules.
And so it becomes a problem for Yahoo or for Google because, in other words, they want that market.
Right.
You know, they want that market. And in spite of Google's, their little slogan, don't do evil.
Right.
If they want to operate there, I'm sure the Chinese can say, well, you can't operate in China if you don't cooperate with us. You know, arresting political dissidents, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's definitely true.
Oh, my goodness. On the plus side, you know, we've got all these wonderful sites that all these entrepreneurs have come up with. And one of them that I went to was an online bookseller, mm-hmm. dangdang.com, that's like Amazon.
Yes.
And, of course, I went to the site and a young woman developed this site.
Yeah,
right?
Peggy Yu-Yu.
Peggy Yu-Yu. Okay. And so what does dangdang mean anyway? Why the double?
It's supposed to sound like a cash register clinking.
Okay. And for her it is, apparently.
I think it is. She's beating Jeff Bezos in China.
She's beating him in terms of books sold. Huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
And what is it about the site? I mean, I think some things about the Amazon site are actually kind of, well, dumbly programmed. For example, if I misspell the name of the author, if I misspell something on Google, it will say, did you mean such and such? If you misspell it on Amazon, it just doesn't take you anywhere. We couldn't find this author yet because you had one letter wrong. But does Dangdang do anything better than Amazon does?
Well, Dangdang was the first Chinese bookseller to develop an online database of books in China. That's mm-hmm. how they got a head start.
Uh-huh.
And Peggy also sells other things besides books on her site. And she has a really good eye for merchandise, for what sells.
Okay. And does she make it any easier than Amazon when you enter the site?
I think it's about the same.
It's about the same. I also know there's this browser, you know, like we might use Internet Explorer here or we might use Firefox or something. There's something called Maxthon, and I went to their website, and the website I went to was in English, and they wanted my business. They wanted me to download the browser.
Right.
What about that?
Well, you can download it here in the U.S., mm-hmm. and it can be downloaded in about 20 different languages. This is one of the first Chinese startups that's gone international. They have over 140 million users worldwide already.
Wow. For this browser.
Right. Uh-huh. Made in China, invented in China.
Now, you've used it, right? You've downloaded
it.
Yeah,
I have.
How does it compare to Internet Explorer? How does it compare to Firefox? What do you think?
Well, it's more flexible, but I think you have to be kind of a techie to really love it.
Mm-hmm. So it does some things like what?
It has some certain bells and whistles, and it has proxy servers. It has one of my favorite features is a go back feature. If you make a mistake, you can go back and go to the place where you were before you messed up.
You mean if you delete it, if you X'd out of a certain page, you can go back. That's a nice – my Firefox doesn't have that. That's very nice.
Yeah.
So tell me, there's also a huge social networking site that's the equivalent. I mean, it's like MySpace and Facebook here and a whole bunch of social networking sites all put together.
Right. This is run by this one very dynamic entrepreneur CEO named Jeff Chen, who's a Stanford graduate and a returnee to China. And he created these multiple tech brands, Web 2.0 brands, all in one company called Oak Pacific. And he's running all these brands at the same time, juggling all of them. And so he's got the Facebook, MySpace, Craigslist, and YouTube all in one company.
Yeah, now the YouTube is interesting. The Chinese version of YouTube, very interesting. And what is it called again? It's called?
His company's called Oak Pacific, and he named it Oak Pacific because he wanted it to grow as sturdy as oak trees.
Uh-huh. But the YouTube site has a different name, which is?
Oh, that's called Tudou.
Tudou, yeah.
Right.
And I went to Tudou. Yeah, I mean, Tudou.com, right? And I looked, and it's just like YouTube.
Right.
And the videos are similar. I mean, a lot of them are kind of silly. I saw one with a little animated thing moving across a woman's desk and fouling up her computer. I mean, the kind of thing that you'd find right on YouTube.
Here. Yeah. And the amazing thing is that this Tudou started at about the same time that YouTube did in the U.S.
And it's got, I think you wrote in Silicon Dragon, maybe 25 million downloads, and YouTube has 100 million or something like that.
Yeah.
That it's doing pretty well.
Tudou is the second largest video sharing site in the world now.
Rebecca Fannin's new book is Silicon Dragon, How China is Winning the Tech Race. And there's a subtitle here, Exclusive Interviews with 12 Top Chinese Entrepreneurs and Their Investors. And we're talking about some of them right now. We're at 614-292-8513 if you'd like to join the conversation. And you could email a comment or question to openline@wosu.org. Well, the subtitle, How China is Winning the Tech Race, does that mean the United States has something to worry about?
Yeah, I do think that this is a wake-up call for the U.S. because what we're seeing from China is that China is moving from a made-in-China kind of mentality to an invented-in-China drive. And this energy level that you see in China, the motivation, the passion, the spirit, the whole entrepreneurial spirit is so alive. When you go there, you just feel it as soon as you get off the plane. I think it's definitely a wake-up call for the U.S.
Mm-hmm. You feel it as soon as you get off the plane. Okay, tell me how you do. What immediately hits you?
Well, I just got back from Beijing June 2nd, and the new airport is open, the new Beijing airport, mm-hmm. and it's just a marvel to be seen. There's a high-speed train that takes the passengers from the gate to into the main terminal. Everything is very high-tech. You move on the new trains that are going to start very soon into the center of the city. The infrastructure is all very modern. When you go to internet cafes, you see loads of youngsters surfing the internet. You see mm-hmm. everybody on their cell phone. You see, as a journalist, when I'm there, I see people who are meeting me at any time of the hour. It's like Silicon Valley was during the whole dot-com boom.
Same feel, because you lived out in Silicon Valley, right?
Right.
You reported on Silicon Valley.
Yeah, I was there during the height of the dot-com boom, so I have this parallels to draw from to see the same sort of similarities that are emerging now in China.
It's interesting, because when I visited China for WOSU-TV 25 years ago, well, I mean, it was totally different. And we bought bicycles to get around Beijing. They were called Flying Pigeon. That was the brand. It was a Chinese bicycle. So five of us bought these bicycles, and we're riding them back to the hotel. And on the way back to the hotel, three of them broke down. Unfortunately, there was a roving bicycle repairman who pulled up next to us, and actually for free because he was very nice, repaired the bicycles. And I remember when we'd tighten the seats, you know, with the bolt, the bolt would snap. I mean, so, you know.
Yeah.
So that's obviously changed considerably.
Yeah. I mean, that is definitely the image that China has. It's a low-cost producer of cheap toys and tainted foods and but I think that when you're there, this is a leading edge trend. This whole tech boom is a real leading edge trend. You have to be there to see it and talk to the entrepreneurs and see the money that's flooding into the market to really get a feel and taste of it.
Of course, we have, you know, Rebecca, you say we might have something to worry about in terms of them, you know, taking some of the initiative away from us. But, you know, presumably we have the same creativity going, don't we, the same spirit of entrepreneurship? I mean, if I go to Silicon Valley now, are they all walking around long-faced or are they innovating just the way they did?
Well, it's a good question because I really don't see the same kind of work ethic in Silicon Valley that I saw a few years ago.
Really?
People are taking off on weekends. They don't take off weekends in China. They're working 24/7. And I do think that Silicon Valley is never going to go away. You're going to have this ecosystem that's there that encourages this entrepreneurship and innovation. You have Stanford University and Berkeley, mm-hmm. which are real drivers of it. But China has Tsinghua University and Peking University. Those are drivers in China.
So maybe when you have a new culture arising, the work ethic, just as in Silicon Valley some years ago, the work ethic can go gung-ho for quite a while because
right.
people are so excited about what they're doing, right?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, this is a real opportunity that they right. didn't have before, right?
Right. And also, some of these people who are in China today are people who got their experience and education at the finest schools in the U.S. and the finest corporations in the U.S., and then they returned home to China to create these startups when China was just opening up to economic reforms. So here you have this talent that's returning home. And I talk about that in the book, how these people, these returnees, they're called sea turtles, created copycats of our favorite brands here in the U.S. But I also, in the book, talk about how this beginning trend has changed now, where you're seeing a whole new breed of innovators coming from China. These are people who are homegrown innovators, people who were schooled in China and have their experience in China. These are the people who are not just copying the best from the West, but they're coming up with new ideas.
So maybe in a movement like this, at first you copy. You do the Chinese version of Facebook. You do the Chinese version of Google. But then you're going to go beyond that, right?
Right.
Yeah. Can you cite any ways in which they've gone beyond the copying?
Right. Well, I think what we're seeing today is a new digital TV standard that's emerging in China and a new standard for 3G telephone service, which will be allow for multimedia phone service in China. And you're beginning to see advances in biotech. There's even a company that I discovered that's working on a treatment for cancer in China. There's all kinds of innovations coming out in clean tech, which obviously is a very necessary area.
And what is that now?
To help clean up the environment with new technologies. Mm-hmm. One of the companies that I talk about is SunTech Power, which is already one of the leading solar producers in the world. It's created in China.
They make solar cells, right?
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And the fellow has more than a dozen patents to do that. There's another company I discovered that's making LEDs. These are the light bulb of the future. The yeah. guy is comparable to Thomas Edison of his day. And he's found a way to make these LEDs on silicon, which is a commodity rather than sapphire, which is a lot more expensive. And I've seen the plant, and it's churning out these little LEDs, which are one day going to replace our conventional light bulb.
Yeah, it's interesting. They're doing that already. I mean, you can already get these LED bulbs, some of them made here, I'm sure, some of them made in China. They use so much less power, and they use less power than even the compact fluorescents that are replacing the incandescent bulbs right now.
Right.
So you're saying in terms of solar power, in terms of products like LEDs, very enterprising Chinese people are forging ahead here.
Right, and creating their own standards. And the issue is that because the Chinese market is so large, are these standards going to end up being the world standards?
Yeah, they could be defined as the world standard.
They could
not?
Be.
Yeah, yeah. So some of these young men and women are like rock stars in China. I mean, they're big personalities?
Big personalities, mavericks. There's even a TV show in China that's modeled on Our Apprentice where the venture capital investors vote on the best entrepreneurial pitch, and then they put their money to work. They actually invest in the companies that they vote as the best.
But would a young Chinese person know some of the men and women you profile in Silicon Dragon? Would they know their image on television? If they saw them walking down the street, they would know who this is?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Robin Lee, not only because he's so handsome, but because he's such a celebrity entrepreneur, he's a multimillionaire. And I've been at conferences where he's spoken. He's just descended upon by hundreds of people trying to get his autograph. He has to run out of the auditorium to escape the hungry hordes.
It's like Steve Jobs of Apple, right? I
mean, exactly.
So Robin Lee, what did he do? What is his business?
Oh, he created the Google of China.
Okay.
Yeah, with a partner beginning in about 1999. He's one of these returnees, these sea turtles who got his experience in the West and then returned to China. And he created this search engine, which actually has a bigger market share than Google does in China.
And Google is fighting back, you note.
They're fighting back. They've hired lots of engineers, but apparently their search engine does not work as well as Baidu in the Mandarin language.
Ah, so of course, obviously you have an enormous advantage if in China if you are Chinese because you know the culture,
right.
You know the language inside
right.
and out. I mean, you have all kinds of cues
exactly.
that an American company coming over there is not going to have.
Well, that's right. And yeah. Google made a mistake in trying to run its business in China from California.
Ouch. Not a very bright.
But now they're running it from Beijing.
Yeah, yeah. Why do they – now they call those young Chinese men and women who get educations over here and then return to China sea turtles. What's the idea there?
It sounds like a Mandarin word for somebody returning. Mm-hmm. So that's how it came about.
And
they periodically return, so – the idea of sea turtles.
Right. It's interesting that they chose to return to China. I mean, you know, because many Chinese people I know got educated here and stayed here because they said, oh, this is where we're going to have our opportunity. I'm thinking of one fellow who was an interpreter for us 25 years ago in Beijing for WOSU-TV, and he turned out to stay here. And he's got a huge importing firm in New Jersey now. He's a multimillionaire at this point.
Uh-huh.
But many are going back now. Huh?
Yeah, and they are becoming multimillionaires. Robin is not the only multimillionaire internet entrepreneur. There are many others who have made fortunes. In fact, there's already been more than 75 Chinese tech companies listed on our U.S. exchanges. And these companies are trading very well. Their stock is doing exceptionally well in many cases.
And there's nothing in the Chinese. In other words, Hu Jintao, the president of China, and other Chinese authorities, they have no problem with these people being multimillionaires.
No.
I mean, no ethical problem. I mean, the Communist Party does not have a problem with this.
Right. There's a delicate dance going on there.
Is there? Tell us about it.
Well, at the same time that you have this whole entrepreneurial spirit bubbling up from the surface, you still have the Communist Party in direct control of the political system.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this dichotomy.
And where do you see that clash or conflict? I mean, how does that?
Well, it's interesting because the Chinese government obviously wants the economy to keep growing. So you are pushing this economic growth. And one of the main drivers is technology, mm-hmm. innovation. So you want these companies to develop. So they are encouraging these companies to develop. At the same time, they are controlling content.
That's a tough road to hoe, isn't it? Because if you want 1,000 flowers to bloom, and you want all these entrepreneurs, and you want, you know, and this is, of course, when you say high tech, it's a knowledge and information industry, right?
Right. Many of these companies are in content.
Yeah. And at the same time, you want to control content. That's going to be, for these young Chinese entrepreneurs, that's going to be a real problem, isn't it?
Mm. Yes, it is. It is for any company doing business in China.
What are some of these entrepreneurs, did they feel free to talk to you about how censorship of information interfered with their ambition?
Yes, actually, when I was in Beijing recently, I interviewed one of the founders of a video sharing site, and
YouTube, it's that kind of thing.
Right, and his own site had been shut down by the Chinese government. His site was not the only one that had been shut down by the Chinese government. There were several video sharing sites shut down at the same time, and I met with him just a few days after his site was shut down. I asked him, "Are you going to be staying in China?" And he looked at me with a sort of funny look. He said, "Well, I'll stay here as long as my business is still here."
Yeah. So he's thinking about other possibilities. Right.
Right.
Yeah. So do you see any amelioration in this kind of dictatorial procedure? I mean, obviously the government fears free information flow. Do you see that lessening at all? Or on the other hand, are they tightening it because of this huge explosion?
Well, I think there's a lot of trends going on now. Certainly with the Tibet protests, there was a real tightening then. But then after the earthquake hit, there was a real openness toward coverage, and even from foreign press. Now with the Olympics coming up, I think that this is going to be a new test for the Chinese government in how they handle freedom of the press.
Mm-hmm. I remember at least American networks reported that right after the earthquake that Chinese reporters descended upon the place to report on it thoroughly. But they had been discouraged from doing that.
Yeah, but they went anyhow.
But they went anyway.
Right.
Yeah. And then later on, the government was able to tighten up again. But they went anyway. They just went into it.
Right.
And you also mentioned that China has 30 million bloggers. I mean, that's a flow of information that any government is going to find really hard to control. How do you police 30 million blogs, right?
It's difficult.
But they do, right?
They do. I know that my recent blog on Huffington Post was just blocked.
Blog on Huffington Post?
Yes.
An American entity was blocked. And what did you say? Why did they block it?
Well, I did talk about how it would be great if the Chinese consulate would somehow get their visa process automated. Because I was so frustrated spending a day and a half at the consulate in New York getting my visa that I just had to write this column. But I also talked about all the new advances coming out of China and how technology is going to have a showcase time during the Olympics for China. And it's a real opening to the West for China. So it was a really positive column.
But nonetheless, some bureaucrat decided that this could be embarrassing, right?
Right. Oh, and yeah. I also spelled out the rules for the new visas, too, that definitely is a stricter process now than there used to be.
My guest, Rebecca Fannin, is international editor of the Hong Kong Weekly Asian Venture Capital Journal. Her new book, Silicon Dragon, How China is Winning the Tech Race. 614-292-8513, open line at WOSU.org. Dave is on the line. Hello, Dave.
Yes, I guess before we get too mesmerized with China and their technology and their progress and so forth, of course, the issues we've had, everything from dog food to cell phones to a prime example is a wine corkscrew, two of them that came from China, and use them twice and they fall apart.
Still, wow.
And I think, in fact, I've gotten to the point where if I see anything that's stamped made in China on it, I avoid it like the plague. So, yeah, I don't know, just something to think about. And then we're also looking at, I guess, the Chinese possibly drilling down in the Gulf. How environmentally conscious are they going to be versus, of course, our own environmental contingent here won't let us drill in these areas. But now the Chinese evidently are going to drill off the shores of Cuba. And like I say, if I had to choose between China and us, cleaning up a mess, I think I would pick us any day.
I think I would too, Dave. Yeah. I mean, Rebecca, two things here. Again, first of all, the quality of the goods coming out of China, Dave said, there's still a big problem.
Hmm.
Have you noticed that? You live over in Hong Kong.
Well, I think if you buy products at Walmart where there are stipulations on how they're made, then many of these Chinese products come from U.S. dictates, where the U.S. manufacturers say we want it made this certain way.
So
I know that this is how Mattel got into trouble.
What happened with Mattel?
With Mattel in the toys that came out of China, they gave their Chinese suppliers certain rules to follow. Those Chinese suppliers followed those rules. And now Mattel has become stricter in the rules for its own Chinese suppliers.
But I'm sure Mattel didn't want their Chinese suppliers to use lead-based paint, did they?
Right.
Well, and they did anyway.
Yes, that's true. I mean, there's definitely things that have slipped through the cracks, and I think that's true with any products from anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, the idea of the environment, you in Silicon Dragon, you mentioned that the pollution in a lot of Chinese cities is horrific. And so what are they thinking now in terms of the environment?
Definitely things are improving very rapidly. In Beijing, they're now measuring the number of blue sky days.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about 30% now, but it's growing very rapidly. And there are many new emission standards for automobiles, and the Chinese are quickly catching up to Western standards.
So they recognize this is a problem. They got to do something about it.
Oh, huge. I mean, look at what L.A. was like 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That's what
mm-hmm.
Beijing is like today.
Yeah. When they say blue sky, what is a blue sky day? How do they define that?
Well, when you can actually see the sky.
Now, of course, you may not see the sky just simply because it's a cloudy day, but are they talking about pollution rather than clouds?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's an amazing city when you do have one of these blue sky days. It's one of the most beautiful cities in the world.
Gorgeous city, yeah.
Because you can
yeah.
see the mountains circling yeah. the whole city.
Well, Dave, okay, thanks for your questions.
I had one other question.
Yeah, quickly now. Uh-huh.
Yeah, the distribution and transportation system that they have in China, I also understand is due to the mountainous regions and so forth, is really apprehensive as far as trying to coordinate everything. So I wonder what your feelings were on that.
Yeah, certainly distribution is a major issue for any company doing business in China.
Mm-hmm.
I remember talking to the founder of Dangdang, and she was telling me how they even use bicycle messengers to deliver some of their books.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Sounds like they've got...
Oh, Dave is...
Okay.
Dropped off for some reason, but thank you. So in other words, the picture here is some incredible entrepreneurs who are coming up with wonderful ideas, not just those recreating American websites, for example, or American products, but also innovating and initiating, but some difficulties and some problems as well.
Right.
And so what is the prediction of specialists? Do they say that in 10 to 20 or 30 years, China, in terms of a high-tech culture, will be where vis-a-vis the United States?
That we'll certainly see a Steve Jobs-like character coming from China,
uh-huh.
if not already.
Uh-huh. Do they think that China will be the equal of the United States in high-tech innovation?
I think that they are telling me that it certainly is a challenge to the U.S. for technology dominance, and particularly if you look at areas as mobile communications and the Internet and Web 2.0, these are really very important industries, and there China is quickly gaining a lead.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca Fannin, Silicon Dragon, how China is winning the tech race. Rebecca, good to have you here. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Back after the news with Steve Kleinither from American Heritage Dictionaries on listener-supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 is NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the Donald R. Glancy Endowed Fund, a legacy of commitment to great programming on WOSU Public Media.